So today we start with what we promised Friday, that is emergence of bosons and fermions. Actually, bosons, semions, and the fermions. From topological order. Okay? So, and this is in the Z2 topological order. Other theories feature emergence of other particles. Okay, so this is the simplest case. Okay, so we have defined, remember, we have defined our operators A, AN, and we know that we have L squared minus one independent ones and associative group as defined by these generators, we call it G, and its order is just 2 to the L squared minus 1. This is easy to compute. And we have defined the reference state that we just call zero, that is all the spins in our system are up. And then we have defined the string operators. In this way. So let me draw the lattice. So we have X strings that run on the dual lattice and carry X. So this would be a string operator associated to this curve gamma. And then we have Z strings that run on the links of the lattice, like this, and carry Z. Okay? So in general, we define them as S, X or Z on the curve gamma. And if it is of the X type, runs gamma must be on the dual lattice. If it is of the Z type, gamma must be on the links of the lattice. And this is just the product of all the links that are on gamma, which again means either they are on the curve or they're crossed by the curve, of the sigma X or Z operator. Okay, so we have defined these string operators. And We have seen that in the ground state, so the ground state of the model has this form. So it has some indices. Okay, so the generic ground state has this form. Is a superposition of our loop operators. So let me call them W1, X, and W2x, so to the power I or to the power j, I and j is equal 0 or 1. And so we sum over all these possible string operators. And then here we put our ground state that has this form. And we have an overall normalization that is 1 over the square root of g, where by this, I mean this. Okay, so this is our generic ground state. Do you agree? Very good. Okay. And we have seen that if we have a string operator of either type that is defined on a closed loop, on a closed string, well, then we have seen this is either the product of A and B's operator that have eigenvalue 1 in the ground state, or it's the product of such operators with the W's operators, which have the same expectation value in the ground state anyway. So this thing is identically 1. And we call this a closed string condensation. Okay. So these are the features that we have seen. Questions? Yeah?
If that string is one of the W loops, mm-hmm. can it take us from one ground state to a different ground state and then have no overlap? Like if psi 0, if you choose the alpha ij to be 0 for all of them except for 1?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, that's correct. So this is closed contractible strings condensation, yeah. In general, it's if you include also the large loops, then you are basically projecting one state on the other, and this can be in general a non-zero value. Okay, so we still call it condensation, but it is identically one only for the contractible ones. That's correct. Thank you. Okay. All right, so let's see how we feature the emergence of bosons and fermions. So first of all, I will claim that these particles, that as you remember, these are called the Z2 vortices and Z2 charges, are bosons. Okay, so how do you know that a particle is a boson or a fermion? What is a boson? How do you come up with that?
Commutation relations?
Hmm?
Commutation relations of the creation and annihilation operators?
Okay, yes. And why do you have those type of commutation relations for bosons and for fermions? Is that really the definition of what a boson or a fermion is?
That to have a well-defined ground state.
Okay, we do have a very well-defined ground state. But generally speaking, if you have, so when you build the Fock space of these guys, right? So you ask that the particles are indistinguishable, right? And if they are indistinguishable, this means that when you exchange them, you can only get a phase. And you require that the bosons are those that get a trivial phase, that is 1. In other words, they belong to the completely symmetric space of your Hilbert space. So it's invariant under exchange. But you want a completely symmetric wave function. Whereas for fermions, or say electrons, you want a completely anti-symmetric wave function. And so you require a Slater determinant that is completely anti-symmetric. And that's why you have exclusion principle, right? So from the algebraic point of view, all boils down to the fact that if you have the wave function of a particle at I and the wave function of a particle at j, and you exchange them, you have either a completely symmetric or anti-symmetric wave function, which means that you get a plus or minus in front. The operator, let me define it, that exchanges them is called the swap operator. And we want to understand whether this state with respect to this state is itself or not with plus or minus one. Then you have a boson or a fermion. So let's, for instance, consider the state of two vortices at P and Q. Okay, so this is produced by acting with an X string on top of the ground state. So our initial state, which is this state, will be equal to, I have my ground state, and then I act with this string, which is an X string, that goes from P to Q. So this is my initial state. Okay? My final state is the state that I obtain after I swap the two particles. Okay? So it's the swap operator between P and Q of my initial state, that is this one. Okay? So now let's see how we do realize a way of realizing the swap operator. So definitely, one thing that I could do is to transport this particle from Q to P. Right? So I start dragging this particle from here to here. And then I can drag this particle from here to here. And in this way, I've swapped that. So you see that if I act with a string that has x everywhere up to here, this particle would be dragged from here to here. And the same for this other one. So this swap operator will be some other s tilde x from q to p times another sigma tilde x from p to q along a curve that is not this one. It's a different one. So this is our swap. And then I have my original Sx from P to Q, side zero. You agree? Is it clear why? Okay, I have this string that is creating these two particles. Now let's say that now I add a piece of string like this. That has x. Now, what does it do? This destroys the particle here and moves it down. And then I keep trying to do that, and this moves my particle from here to here. This is what I'm doing. Is it clear? Okay. Now, what do you think these operators and this global operator here and this one, do they commute or not? Right? It's all x, so they commute. So I can just write this as SXPQ, and now I have my pair of S tildes acting on psi 0. But this operator is a loop. It's a contractible loop. And the contractible loop on psi 0 is psi 0. Because it's just the product of A operators, and HA on psi 0 is trivial. So this is just SXPQ psi 0, which is my psi in. So you see, psi out is equal to psi in after an exchange, and therefore they're bosons. So Z2 vortices are bosons, and it's not hard to see that exactly by the same argument, Z two charges are bosons as well. Okay. Well, that's fine. So they're bosons. Okay. But do we have something more interesting than trivial phases gained by exchange? So let's show that although both the charges and the vortices are bosons, they're not trivial bosons because they are what we call mutual semions. Which means this, they acquire the wave function of the of two semions acquires a non-trivial phase, namely minus one in this case, if one drags one of them around the other. Which, as you know, in the case of the electromagnetic field is called Aronoff-Bohm effect. Right? What happens when you take a charge around a flux of magnetic field, the wave function gets a phase. It is this holonomy. And now this is a very simple theory, it's Z2, so the only phase that you can take, you know, you only have plus one and minus one. So we get minus one. Let's see. Okay, so this is my, so I want to take a charge. Okay, so this is Z2 charge, so there is Z everywhere. Okay, so these are two charges, and then I have two vortices at P and Q that are created by an X string. Okay, and now what I want to do is that I want to take this electron, this charge, and drag it around this particle and go back. Okay, so I want to do this movement. And what operator will drag this object in this way? So this is a Z string, right? So it means that to move this particle, I have to add pieces of a Z string. So this is an operator that is Z, 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 Z everywhere. Okay. And you see that after I dragged it, I am in the same eigenstate as before because this is a loop. So I've not changed my overall wave function. However, let's see what happens now, because my initial state is my ground state. Then I have my SXPQ, because I've created, so my initial state is the state of two vortices and two charges. So this is my initial state. And my out state, which as a wave function is exactly the same as before. All I can get is an overall phase, will be this sigma z operator on a loop, psi in, which is sz, c, sz, ab, sx, pq, psi 0. Now let's play with our commutation relations. Okay, so these two commute because they're all Z operators. And now I would like to bring this guy over this one. And I know that once this loop operator gets on the ground state, it's trivial, that's not. I get back to the ground state. Okay, so I just need to jump from here to here. And now let's look at it. It's this operator that I'm trying to commute with this string operator. and you see that they cross in a point. And this is because of topology. It's because I went around this church. And no matter how far apart I do that, I always get exactly the same one crossing. The only thing that would prevent me to see that is if I do this in this way, if I enclose also this one. Well, but if I enclose also this one, this is not representing one flux, right? I'm taking it around two fluxes. Fine. If you take it around two fluxes, nothing happens. But if you take it around one flux, so it's like a monopole, right? It means that you have to imagine this string is very far away, the other one. Then you are forced to cross in one point. So you would be left with SZAB, SXPQ, with a minus, SZC, psi 0. And now this is just psi 0. And now this is minus psi in. So they are mutual semians. They have Aronoff-Bohm effect, which is a topological interaction. Does not depend on the distance. If you want to describe it in the continuum limit, the theory of these particles, you need a so-called topological quantum field theory, which is a theory where, you know, you have a Lagrangian that only has topological terms. It's just, you just have a connection. In other words, there is no energy exchange in these interactions, because otherwise, if you could exchange energy at arbitrary distances, this would not be a local theory. But a topological theory can, can have arbitrary distance, can be topological if there is no exchange of energy. That's why you can only represent it with a Lagrangian and not with a Hamiltonian. Okay, so they are mutual semians. And now, emergent fermions. So now imagine that you have the bound state of a charge and a vortex. So this means that you have a vortex here and the charge here. So you have a pair. And you bind them together, which means from now on, you will not allow them to be far apart too much. Okay? And now you play the same game as before. You try to exchange them, to swap them as before. So do this as an exercise, okay? So try to bring this pair here. So this one will have to do something like this. And this one will have to do somehow something like something else, like this. And then this one has to go the other way around and show that you always get one crossing, or actually, no matter what you do, an odd number of crossings between X and Z. And therefore, if you see this as a particle, when you exchange this particle, you have psi out equal minus psi in. And therefore, they're fermions. Okay. So this is all you can do with the Z2 theory. However, any gauge, local gauge group can be represented on a lattice, not just discrete, even U1 or continuous gauge groups. And so from a spin system, you can have emergent any particle you want. of course, the why you get, you know, the why the emergent particles of these local symmetries are what they are becomes more complicated, but you can kind of believe it now because you've seen this example. So you can get, you know, gravitons, photons, anything you want. Okay. Now, let's remark more things about the difference between topological order and symmetry breaking. Okay. So you see our ground state, let me take just one of them, the one without the W's. Is the equal superposition of our symmetries. The G are symmetries of the original Hamilton. So one might ask, okay, but then why it's really different from, say, the symmetric ground state in the Ising model, where what I do is that I apply, so I have all spins up, and then I do an equal superposition. So now I have only two group elements, right, for my global Z2 symmetry. That is, I do nothing, the identity, or I flip all the spins. So I could do this superposition. And I say, okay, why this state is really different from this state? And the reason is the following. The reason is that we have seen that the algebra I want to compare this state with the superposition between this state and, say, one of these ones. Okay? So I have a superposition with the equal coefficients between this and this. And I want to compare, because these are our two degenerate ground states, right? We have four of them. I'm thinking of two of them. I do an equal superposition. So I do psi 0 plus wx1 psi 0 over square root of 2, which has the form, again, the identity plus wx1 over square root of 2 of psi 0. Okay, so now this really looks a bit like this one. Because this is a non-local operator, I'm flipping all the spins. This is a non-local operator, I'm flipping all the spins around a large loop. So what's the difference, right? It kind of looks the same. Why we're making such so much noise about this? Am I playing, you know, games, or there is really something there? Okay, so let's look at this in a bit more detail. So I will repeat some of the things that I already said, but, you know, through an angle that is very important. Okay, so first of all, there is a slight difference. Because it is true that this is a non-local operator. And it is true that this is a non-local operator. But this is an operator everywhere. Okay, it's a bit trivial. It's really, I'm operating on all the spins at the same time. This is not all the spins at the same time. It's non-local, but it looks at the topology of the system. Okay, so there is a little difference. But there is a much more important difference, that the algebra in the ground state of Ising and the algebra in the ground state of the toric code, this one contains local operators. And this one does not. This is my claim, okay? So what do I mean? First of all, let's check that this algebra does contain local operators. It is true that to move from this state to this state, all spins up and all spins down, I do need a global operator, which is our Z2 symmetry, that indeed this state breaks, right? This maximally symmetry breaking state. However, not every element in the algebra of this space is non-local. Consider, for instance, this state. So this is a state in this ground space, right? And consider its orthogonal counterpart, that is the one with the minus. And my claim is they are connected by a very by a local operator. In fact, if you just act with the sigma z on one spin I, this is what you get. So you see, you have a non-trivial local algebra in this ground space. And this has profound consequences. Because if I have, in general, two states, psi 1 and psi 2, so these are two states in my ground space that are connected by a local operator, like this one. So this means that my local operator O has non-vanishing matrix elements between these two states. Then I can always define symmetric states that are psi 1 plus psi 2 over square root of 2. These are kets. And if I do that, this is local on I, then the correlation functions between in psi plus are of the order alpha square. It's what we call the long range order. So you see that the long range order is a direct consequence of the fact that the two degenerate ground states can be connected by a local operator. But what happens in topological order? In topological order, we have seen that this state and this other state are connected by a non-local operator. And so this changes everything. Because if they are not connected by a local operator, then all the correlation functions decay exponentially. Now, so far, I have kind of used this fact. I have assumed that they're only connected by a non-local operator. And I've used this fact to prove that, you know, the splitting is zero because you need to go to higher order in perturbation theory. Because, yeah, it is true that this non-local operator connects the two states. But how do we know that there are no local operators that connect them? We really need to show that. That if I have my different states, psi 0 and psi 0 prime. So psi 0 and psi 0 prime are in the ground state of the toric code, then all these operators have zero expectation, you know, not have zero off diagonal matrix elements. They do not connect them. Or, which is the same, because it's the same statement just in other in another basis, but let me write it nonetheless, they cannot distinguish any two states. These two statements are the same statement. It's just a change of basis. Saying that this operator connects the two states is the same thing than saying that this operator sees a difference between this state and this state. It means that in that space, you can rotate these two states in this new basis, and now you have that sigma z on all spins up sees a difference, is plus one, and sigma z on all spins down is minus one. So this is what we should show, and this statement is equivalent to saying that if any local operator cannot see, and by local I really just mean local, not just on one spins. By local, now I will use a very strong sense of local, any operator that is non-topological. Okay, so as long as an operator OA, where A is contractible, then this should be true for any pair of states in LTC. So this is identical to saying that for every psi in the ground state, so for every pair, then psi restricted to A is identical to psi prime restricted to A. So I'm saying there are no local operators that can connect them, and therefore they're identical. Is this clear? Are you familiar with the meaning of the reduced density matrix? Okay. So this is just the reduced density matrix. This means that I take my whole state psi, and psi A will be trace out whatever else is not A from the total state psi. And now I'm writing them like this because I mean they are density matrices, they are not cats. Okay. So this is my state. This is what we want to show, that this is identically true. And so let's do that, because this is a very instructive proof. So that for any pair of states in the ground space of the toric code, their restriction to A is identical, no matter where you start with. So you cannot distinguish them locally. Okay? So let's do that. And so let me write the density matrix of my generic state in a ground space of LTC. And so I will use that expression, the one that psi 0 is equal 1 over g, that thing there. Okay? So let me write that. Okay, because that's the generic state. It's a generic superposition in that space with the W operators. Okay, so the density matrix will be this thing. Then I will have sum over I, j, I prime, j prime, alpha star, I prime, j prime, alpha, I, j. And then I will have all these things. Did I forget anything? No. Okay. G and G prime in G. Okay. In G. Okay. So now there is an important trick that we're going to use. If G tilde is an element of a group, then the sum over this is identical to the sum over this. Are you familiar with this? It's one of the basic group properties, because when you have, because it's a group, G multiplied to another group element just translates me to another group element, and I'm summing over all of them, so I just reshuffle them. Right? In other words, the average of the group is left invariant or right invariant, depending on how you act. It's both. We are going to use that also later when we do things away from equilibrium. So this means that I could pick any G tilde that I want and put it here, and nothing changes, right? I can do that. I'm allowed to do that because of this property. And I, since I can pick any G tilde I want, I will pick it depending on how I want to, on what is A, right? Because now, remember, our goal is that from this total density matrix, we want to trace out all the spins but some contractible region. So what is that I'm going to do? I have my, this is my lattice, and this is my region A. And everything else is B. So this is a density matrix defined everywhere. I'm going to trace out B. So, you know, depending on where is A, because I can choose A anywhere I want, with any shape I want, just needs to be contractible. It could happen that A is in the way of some of these W loops. It could be in the way of this W loop, or in the way of both, or in the way of the other one. You know, it could be in the way. Well, so what I will do is that I will use my freedom of choosing G tilde in order to default. Let's say that it's in the way of this one. Then I can always deform my W in this way. So by adding this, this becomes the identity, and I move it out of A. So this means that I can always pick G tilde so that G tilde times this is an operator that acts only in B. Do you agree with me? Okay, so now let's take the trace. Now I want to say, write psi A is equal to the trace over B of psi. So it's 1 over G. Let me rewrite this guy, ij, I prime, j prime, alpha star, I prime, j prime, alpha ij. And now, okay, another thing. I'm summing over all this g and g prime. But what is the generic g? What is it? What shape does it have, the generic G? It's a loop. It's a loop that carries X, right? So let's say it's this loop. Let me draw it yellow. It's just the product of X's, right? It's X, 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 X times X, 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 X. So each G has always the form GA tensor GB. Because it's just a product. So now you can write this as GA, G prime A, tensor. Cannot be written like GA, G prime A, tensor, GB, G prime B. Right? Okay. So when we take the trace, I have GA, G prime A, and then I'm taking the trace, which means I'm doing the inner product on the G, on the B part. Right? That's what it means. So I have, if I'm doing the, then I have a G prime B, then here I have a GB, and now I have all my W's, W1X, I, W2X, J, W1X, I prime, W2X, J prime. And the W's are completely inside the B. Because these are the dressed. They are the W's dressed up by this G tilde. I could put a tilde here so it's more clear. So they're outside A. They're the identity on A. So they only appear inside the inner product on the B part. Now notice that, so in the end, this whole product is the product of many sigma x's operator, and I'm taking the expectation value of the product of these sigma x operators in the vacuum, all spins up. So if all this product is not the identity, if I flip any spin, the expectation value in the vacuum of flipping some spins is zero, right? Because I would end up with the overlap between all spins up and some spin is flipped in their orthogonal states. So in order for this thing to not be zero and contribute to this sum, whatever is inside here must be the identity. And now remember that these guys are the restriction to B of a contractible loop. So the restriction to B of a contractible loop is either an open string or it's a contractible loop. So it cannot be any of the W's. So this means that already the product of the W's must be the identity. And because W1x and W2x are very different, in fact, they don't touch at all the same spins, this means that W1x I power I to W1x power I prime must be the identity, which means that I must be equal to I prime. So if I is zero, means I don't have it, and also I must not have it there, or I have it both in I and I prime, so that I square to the identity. And the same for the two. So you see that this part in here gives me a delta II prime. So this is equal to delta II prime, delta JJ prime, G prime B, GB. Because then, you know, I could be fine by the W operators, but still this may give us a zero overlap. So what happens when I implement this delta here is that now this is becomes completely uncorrelated by the rest of the sum. And this just becomes the sum over ij over alpha ij modulus square, which is the normalization is 1. So let me write, so what we've discovered, that psi a is 1 over g. Then I have the sum over gg prime of ga, g prime a, inner product, g prime b, gb. And this does not depend on the coefficients alpha ij. So no matter what state I start with, the reduced state is always the same, which is the promised result. And this is exactly what topological order is. This means that the only algebra that moves me inside the ground space is the non-local algebra. And from this, descend all the properties that we've seen so far. For instance, the robustness of the degeneracy. Okay. Now, in the next, say, 10 minutes, if you bear with me, I want to show you the last thing that we're going to say about topological order, which is this. Okay, so we would really like to characterize order in a quantum many-body systems by using correlations. Because correlations refer to the correlations between different parts of the system. They usually have easy physical interpretation, and because it's a unifying point of view. However, from the point of view of correlation functions, we don't know how to distinguish topological order from a paramagnet. But if we only look at correlation functions, they decay exponentially. So we would like to find some kind of correlation in a system that tells us that something is topologically ordered. And that's why now we need to summon something else that is correlations, but it's not correlation functions. And this thing is entanglement. So. So in the recent years, there has been a lot of effort in trying to understand how the emergent properties of quantum many-body systems can be tracked down to the behavior of entanglement. Because entanglement is actually what happens every time you do a superposition of many-body states. as soon, you know, if you have only one particle, you do a superposition of 0 and 1, okay, there is no entanglement. But as soon as you have many particles, so you have a tensor product, and you start superimposing different configurations of 0 and 1s, you get an entangled state. In fact, we will see, starting from tomorrow, that you always, in whatever meaning that, in whatever statistical meaning, you always get an entangled state. It's basically impossible to make a superposition of states without getting an entangled state. When I say impossible, I mean it in the statistical sense. We will see that. So, you know, the pattern, whatever pattern of entanglement you have in a many-body ground state wave function should tell you about the important things of the system, like the emergent properties. Okay, so this is what one likes. So at Perimeter Institute, since, I don't remember, 2011 or 12, something like that, there's been a series of conferences called Emergence and Entanglement that have to do with this topic. Okay, so let's see how the topological order is encoded somehow in the entanglement of the wave function. So how many of you are familiar with the notions of entanglement that, okay, yeah, spare us the definition, we don't want to hear that. Or would you like to hear something about that? Please raise your hands. Who wants to hear something about that? Okay, so some of you want to hear something about that. Okay, so for our goals, what we care about is this. We start with a pure state. Okay? And the pure state has the property that its density matrix is trivial, just this. Which means you have probability 1 on being in the state psi. So if you diagonalize this density matrix, oh, well, any basis in which this is one of the elements of the basis is a basis that diagonalizes it. It looks like this. 1 in this matrix element, 0 everywhere else. And these are the probabilities of being in any state of that basis. Generally speaking, a generic density matrix will have a generic expression. And then you try to diagonalize it, so you try to find the basis in which this becomes diagonal. Let me call it K. And you are left with a diagonal thing. And this diagonal thing, because this is Hermitian, and because the trace of psi is 1, are a pk, which is a probability distribution. So in this basis, this looks like p1 pn. So a density matrix always tells you what is the probability distribution of being in either state of a specific basis. Okay? Now, the difference between a pure state and a state that is the mixture with a classical probability distribution like this of k states is exactly that these are different probability distributions. This is extremal, and this is not. This is more squat over our states. So what measures how squat is a probability distribution? What kind of quantity?
Standard deviation.
That's one thing. The variance measures that. But in fact, the variance will contain what I'm going to say. So anything that contains these powers, right? It's the powers or the so-called momenta of a probability distribution that contain this type of information. Because, you know, you see when alpha is equal to 1, the sum of all these guys must be 1 because it is our normalization. But when alpha is a different value, for instance, when alpha is equal to 2, then you see that, well, in this case, the sum of all these probabilities squared is still 1. Whereas, say, in the other extreme case, that each of these guys is 1 over n, the sum over 1 over n squared is n over n squared, which is 1 over n. And there is no, you cannot mix it more than this, more than having all the probabilities the same. So the sum of these objects, when this sum is, you know, it is upper bounded by 1, and this lower bounded by 1 over n. So this is the type of quantities that tell you how non-pure you are. And a convenient quantity is the so-called alpha Reni entropy, which is this. Where by this I mean not so homework for you, alpha equals 0 is the rank of psi. Alpha going to 1, well, you need to do some limit, right? Because otherwise this diverges. This is the so-called von Neumann entropy. So S1 is minus log rho, sorry, minus the trace of psi log psi. Alpha equal 2 is the so-called 2 Reni entropy, which is minus the log of the trace of psi square. And this is what is called the purity. So remember these quantities because we will make large use of them. So far, there is no entanglement here, right? I'm just talking about things being pure or not pure. However, here's the thing. In quantum theory, there is this thing that you take a state and you look at it locally, and this is pure. Then you look at it locally, psi A, and then it can happen not pure. This is actually vice versa. Every non-pure state can be seen as a pure state on a larger Hilbert space. This is called purification. And actually, this only happens in quantum mechanics. So if you want, you could in some, with some additional assumption, derive everything about quantum mechanics, the Hilbert space, everything from this fact, that there is always a way to purify whatever you're using to describe your experiments. OK. So when this happens, we say that psi is entangled. And you see psi is entangled if psi A is not pure. So the entanglement is with respect to this tensor product structure. if I change TensorFlow structure, for me, the subsystem A is another subsystem, then Psi could be non-entangled in that TensorFlow structure. In this TPS. So you see, the whole goal is that you take your state, you compute the partial trace, and then you compute one of these quantities, these Rényi entropies, on this state. For instance, the trace of psi A square, so the sum of its eigenvalues squared. Okay. So in the case of topological order, we have already done all the work of computing the trace. It's here. So what is left for us to do is to multiply that by itself and then take the trace. And so this is very instructive, and I want to show it to you, but it takes more than 10 minutes, so I cannot show you right now. So I'll do it tomorrow at the tutorial, okay? I'll come by and I'll show this to you at the tutorial. So tomorrow we will see what these quantities, these Rényi entropies, look like in the topological order, but I showed you how we're going to do that, right? We're going to take powers of this object and then take the trace. Okay, so we'll see it tomorrow. So with this little appendix of tomorrow, this concludes, and we will see that something comes up that reveals topological order in the entanglement pattern. So with this, we have concluded our journey into understanding what is quantum order from the point of view of correlation functions and symmetries or breaking of symmetry or topological order, something that goes beyond symmetry, the distinguishability of states, and all of that. So from tomorrow, we change focus because this is order at zero temperature, right? Remember, we wanted to distinguish between fluctuations that come from having a classical probability distribution that is thermal. We want to distinguish from that, from the quantum fluctuations that are in the ground state only. So tomorrow we change focus. Now we will look for what are the emergent properties of quantum matter in states that are not ground states. And in fact, they are not eigenstates of your system, but they are away from equilibrium. So they evolve. So we switch to time domain. Okay, so everything from tomorrow will be about time evolution of quantum many-body systems.